My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Very glad to be here. If I could see some more little faces rather than little black squares, that would be helpful. It's really helpful to be able to see the people I'm talking to. So thank you for that. I do go to plenty of online meetings, but I have to say they're part of my recovery, but I couldn't do it without face-to-face meetings. I couldn't have got sober without face-to-face meetings. There are legitimate reasons for meetings being online, including people living in remote areas, connecting with people from different parts of the world. But there's something about face-to-face meetings. When I was in trouble in my first year, I had to place myself physically inside meetings in order to feel safe from drinking. Just hold, I'm in an open plan office. I'm just going to ask someone to be a bit quieter. There we go. Sorry, people think sometimes everyone else is gone and they haven't. So I'm going to try and keep my voice down for him as well. But in my first year, I needed to be in physical meetings. I stayed sober one day at a time. I didn't have a relationship with a higher power. The point of the steps is you're blocked from that power, so you need something to substitute for that power until you take the steps. Then you've got the power. And until then, I accessed a higher power through people, and I needed those people physically in the same room as me. I needed to place myself physically amongst them, not at the back. When I go to physical meetings, we sometimes refer to the back row in the room as the relapse row. We tell, but I say to people, "Are you sitting in the relapse row tonight? Why are you sitting there? Why not sit at the front where there are people who are going to recover?" And there's a direct correlation between where people sit and how well they do. Very, very clear, demonstrable connection. The people that sit at the front and take part seem to be much more likely to get well. Having said that, I'm very glad to be here. It's good to hear the different accents. It's nice to go to a meeting in South Africa. I know almost nothing about South Africa, other than there's a lot of AA there. My date of sobriety is the 24th of July, 1993. It wasn't the first time I tried to stop drinking. I first tried to stop drinking in 1990, and I say tried. Now I succeeded. The problem is not my failure to try to stop. My problem is that I changed my mind and I want to start drinking again. Very, very straightforward. People make a big complicated deal about alcoholism sometimes in terms of what it is. I think it's very simple. I've got a mind that tells me to drink and a body that can't stop. There we go. A mind that tells me to drink and a body that can't stop. The body ain't going to change. The only thing that can change is my mind. But even with that, I will, I haven't had a drink for 30 years, but occasionally I have some kooky thoughts about alcohol. Recovery reduces the frequency and severity of those thoughts. It reduces their power, but it doesn't eliminate them altogether. The point of AA is not to make me into some kind of super rational being that never has an irrational thought. If that is the aim, I'm stuffed. What AA does is it takes my thinking and says, that's no longer going to be your higher power. So it no longer matters that you want to drink or you feel like drinking or drinking seems safe. You've taken yourself offline as your own higher power and you're going to live differently. Sometimes, years ago, I've heard someone say in a meeting, perfectly nice person with a perfectly good program, and what they said was, I've got my meetings, I've got my big book, I've got my sponsor, I'm doing my steps. And it troubled me when I heard, I thought there's something wrong in there. And it took me years to figure out what it was. It was like the spider sitting at the center of its web with all of its little things stuck in its web that It's like, I'm here. I've got all of these things. I'm the great emperor with my little servants. Like, the steps are there to serve me. The higher powers there to serve me. The meetings are there to serve me. For me to stay sober, I've got to not be the center of attention, not be the center of the whole deal. The higher power doesn't is not this tiny little creature that sits in my pocket and does what I want it to do when I pray nicely. No, it is very, very big, and I am very, very small. I belong to it. It is not my higher power. In the same way as I say my margarine, my slippers, my whatever. It's not a little object that belongs to me. Even, using the word God, my God, well, is that different than everyone else's? It's very dangerous for me to talk that way, because it implies that I'm using these things, even the phrase using the tools of the program. I'm still in charge, but now I'm using tools and I'm going to do super well because I'm using the right tools. No, completely wrong. I give myself to this program, and I do what this program tells me to do. The program is not a set of tools for me to learn how to live differently. It is something that I am surrendered to so that I don't have to consult my own head. I don't know what anyone else is like first thing in the morning. Some days I wake up in a very, very good condition. Some days I wake up in a very bad condition in terms of the nature of the thoughts that are going through my mind. What I've learned to do first thing in the morning, as soon as before I'm properly awake, so I wake up at about 5 a.m., but I get up at around 6. I try and stay in bed as long as possible to get a full sleep. And in that period of about an hour before I get up, before I'm fully awake, I'm praying. I've got some prayers memorized. I pray the memorized prayers. I get up. The first thing I do, I put some, turn the headphones on, turn the phone on, and listen to a morning service for the religious denomination I belong to. So the first thing I do once I'm conscious, I'm in a service. I'm listening to the standard daily prayers about God. I put myself in that position straight away. The first couple of hours of the day are all about God, and I go to a little meditation meeting at 7 a.m. I listen to all sorts of things. I do the planning for the day. I send out some readings to some people. I reply to the emails, or rather the WhatsApp messages from sponsees which have come in overnight. A couple of hours of placing myself at the service of the higher power, and bang, straight in there. And by the time I'm making my first cup of coffee, I'm fine. It doesn't matter what those thoughts were in that twilight period around 5 a.m. The mind does very strange things overnight and during one's dreams when it's processing things. Those thoughts that I wake up with are not indicative of really anything. They're certainly not indicative of my general spiritual condition. But here's the thing. I used to start the day and say, oh, I'm in the most terrible state. I'm going to sort it out. I haven't got time. I feel too depressed. I haven't got time for the program. I haven't got time for God. And those early morning thoughts would color the whole day. They dictate the course of my actions. I'd do all sorts of things to fix myself because I felt. What I've learned is that, and it's interesting when you read religious and philosophical traditions, lots of people talk about this. C.S. Lewis talks about this. You wake up every day and it is as though you have to re-establish your relationship with God from scratch. I know in the Jewish tradition, the idea is that you're sort of left overnight by you're left to lower powers overnight. Your soul is, as it were, taken away, and you wake up in the morning, your soul is given back to you. And the first prayer you say in the morning is thank you for your soul being given back. The early morning state, very dangerous if I think it's real and I think it's me. So the first thing I do is reconnect with the higher power, which is my source of power for everything. To stay sober, yeah, I've got to sort my life out. However, the key thing is to, as I said, to live differently, to live on a new basis, which is why they say in the big book, the spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. The end of the day is bookended with prayer and meditation as well, the last sort of half hour. My other half and I eat very late, and then I do the housework after that, and I always put something on to listen to, and I do prayers before I go to sleep. Now, during the day, I get an awful lot done. I've got a couple of jobs, I'm married. There's a lot going on in my life, a lot of service, sponsorship. But what matters is the framework and God and the relationship with God and the program suggestions around that relationship with God. It's the absolute core of everything. It's the basis of everything. In the big book, it talks about self being the problem. Have you ever switched on the news and heard someone say, yeah, I know other people have got character defects, but my problem is self. I'm not going to blame anyone for anything. I'm not going to point the finger. I'm just going to admit my own wrongs. And then the next person will say, oh, yeah, I mean, I just have to practice patience and tolerance with other people. But here are my wrongs, which I'm going to publicly admit. You never hear that. You don't have that on Twitter. You don't go on Twitter and read people sharing their own experience, strength and hope. There is almost nothing in society at the very, very public level which seems to support this way of life we're offered in here. In fact, the currents are going in the opposite direction. Which is why I can't go with the flow of how society operates, particularly Western society. I can't. If I do that, I am going to drink. This is not a bridge to normal living, as in a bridge to the way regular folks live, because regular folks mostly live without God. Thank God it's not a bridge to that, a bridge to atheism and materialism and hedonism. No, it's a bridge away from that. It's a bridge towards a very strange form of life, where from the outside, if you had a camera tracking me during the day, I just look like a regular person with a regular job and a regular home and a regular marriage and all of these things. But inside, I know I'm dancing to a different tune. So although I've got all these ordinary things, like for instance, with my work, I don't treat my work as something I'm doing for me or for my own betterment or furtherment or advancement. I'm serving God, and I happen to be doing it at work. It looks like I'm working for other people. I know I'm not, which means it doesn't matter what they think about me, which is marvellous. And because of that, I can say no to clients. I can turn down whole streams of work because the higher power says to me, nope, that's not a good relationship to develop. We need you elsewhere. So I'm able to say no to things that other people would think I'm a fool for saying no to. I'm not a fool. I know which side of my bread is buttered. People say they're frightened about the future. I'm not frightened about the future because I know what's in my future. The higher power is in my future. Every second of every day, the higher power is going to be, God is going to be there. Whatever I'm doing, wherever I'm going, whatever happens, if the bomb drops, God will be there in the middle of it, and I'll say a few Hail Marys. God help me. I don't care. I don't care what's going to happen. It talks on page 63 as well about we all be well in the here and the hereafter. I didn't go looking for a religion, but I got a sense from doing the steps that there was a hereafter. And I'm not frightened of death. Anne Lamott says that death is a fairly major change of address. I don't believe that when my physical body gives out, there's going to be a little bit of disruption, I think, for me and for the other people around me. But it's a temporary disruption. I'm confident I will see people again. And this is the funny thing about faith. If you took an average AA room and you pushed an alcoholic in there, and then you looked around, and as you know, Bob B says, sometimes it looks like the bar in Star Wars or a collection of Dr. Seuss characters, and I include myself in that. And you say, this bunch of jokers can permanently and effectively treat the alcoholism of this individual who has cost hundreds of thousands of pounds of public money and has had some of the most highly paid professionals in the country poring over the details of their sordid little case. And you look at the people in AA, and I include myself in this, who can't find my behind with both hands, and say, well, we can help them. It doesn't make sense. But when you've been to a few meetings, you know it's real. I went to a meeting January 1993, wasn't my last drink. My last drink was 6 months later. I went to a meeting, I looked around at the bunch of jokers and thought, I'm going to be all right now. What's that? It's faith. It's not evidence-based, it's faith-based, because it's about knowing things which cannot be proved, which cannot be scientifically nailed down. You try and dissect a living creature and you have to kill it to dissect it. And it's the same with trying to figure out AA. I can't figure out AA. I have faith that it works. And that faith has extended from the AA room to sponsors to the AA program to God generally. And there are lots of, it's a wonderful line in the book. It talks about growing in faith, how there are ideas which seemed completely impossible, but as you grow in faith, they become possible. So I believe in all sorts of things. You know, regular folks might think a little bit kooky, but I know they're real. I know that the powers of good in this world are real. I know the powers of good in AA are real. I'm 100% certain that praying for people doesn't just help me psychologically as a trick, that it helps them too. Absolutely no doubt about that. I can, in another context, I might tell some stories about that. But I need to keep it a little bit basic because it's a regular AA meeting. So what did I have to do? As I said, I didn't start off having a relationship with a higher power in AA. There were flashes. There was this moment when I first addressed a higher power, and I was responded to in rather dramatic form by having the obsession to drink for that day removed suddenly and quite effectively, such that I could that night go to sleep. I knew I was going to drink. I would have drunk if there had not been that intervention, which was brought about by that prayer. And all of the arguments in the world won't convince anyone that God exists. One experience is worth all of the argue is worth more than all of the arguments put together. After that one experience, I thought, I'm really stuffed now, because I now know that I now know. So it's even beyond faith. I now know there is a power greater than myself which will keep me sober if I want to remain sober, if I will to remain sober and ask it for help. And here's the interesting thing. Sometimes I don't want to remain sober, but I'm willing to remain sober. The problem with my wanting, the little wanting machine inside me doesn't know what it wants. One minute it wants this thing, the next minute it wants the other thing. One minute it wants a lovely, stable, permanent marriage, the next minute it wants to be a little bit of a playboy. It doesn't know what it wants. It just wants, and then it names things and it changes every 5 minutes. That wanting machine was my higher power, and I cannot afford to have the wanting machine as my higher power today. I've got to have God as my higher power. Grady O.H., which is who is my I think my favorite AA speaker, very unconventional. She swears a lot. If you don't like swearing, don't listen to her. I think there's only one recording of her even, but she Serenity Sam is the other one I very much like. Again, very unconventional, as they say it how it is. And one of the things that she says, she has a go at all sorts of things. She's very naughty, and she has a go at people saying that, "Dear, I have a choice." And now I know what people mean when they say that, but What she says is, thank God I don't have a choice. If I had a choice, I'd choose drink. But I've turned my will and life over to God, and God isn't thirsty, so we don't drink. And that's how it works. This is about saying, I'm such a basket case. I'm such a liability. I'm such a danger to myself. I have to be a very, very small, idiot servant of God. If I'm going to live long and prosper on this planet, that's who I need to be. Not wise, not special. There was someone who wrote some very good stuff, AA materials on the steps, traditions, and concepts decades ago, and he's still sober. But the chap has decided he's an atheist now and that the higher power is the wise old timers in AA. And guess who's one of the wise old timers? He is. He's other people's higher power, apparently. Very dangerous for me, that. If I think, because I've been here for 30 years, I can somehow assume the role of my own higher power, I am sunk. Absolutely sunk. So I'm just as much of an idiot liability to myself as I ever was. Grace, there but for the grace of God go I, is one of those slogans. And grace is, let's see if I can get this right, grace is an unmerited gift of power to do what I should but can't. Unmerited gift of power to do what I should but can't. What I can't do on my own is stay sober. What I should do is stay sober. What is grace? The gift of the power to stay sober. And I don't earn that by being good. I earn that. I know I didn't even earn it. I lay myself open to it by going to God with open hands and saying, I do not know how to live. I cannot cope on my own. Now, the funny thing with saying I cannot cope on my own, you look at my life, you think, this is someone who's coping. This is someone who's thriving. It looks from the outside. My job is going extremely well. My marriage is going extremely well. My finances are going extremely well and are very stable and very orderly. Everything is nailed down. It is not because I'm competent. It's because of grace. It's because I'm incompetent. I go to a power so massively greater than me. I can do whatever I need to do because I'm given the power to do it. I came to AA with a little touch of mental illness on top of alcoholism, and none of that is manifesting. I'm sure it would come back if I didn't do what I do in AA. Sometimes they say, you need to stay in the middle of the AA bed. And I know what people mean by that, as in right in the heart of AA. But in some ways, I think what I've needed to do is, well, a couple of things. But to work the AA program in something of an extreme way. So when it says to do certain things every day, to literally do those things every day. When it says made amends to all such people, in other words, all those we had harmed in step eight, it really does mean all of them. And when it says don't delay, it means don't delay. There was one round of steps where I went through the past with a finer tooth comb than I'd ever gone through it before. And I found between 70 and 80 people I needed to approach or address or do something with in step nine. And I didn't delay, and I got through the list in a matter of days. As I just took time off work and got it done. I got the job done. I didn't do it elegantly. I don't know if I did it well, but I did it. Frankly, I think this is about doing the program in an extreme way. The other thing which I'm more and more convinced of, looking around AA, one's got to keep one's eyes open. The mistake, you see, if one had to find one's way simply in the dark, you know, fumbling through with one's own experience, one wouldn't get anywhere. Fortunately, we have the ability to observe what everyone else around us in AA does, and there is a lesson in everyone. And I'm very careful to observe what happens to people in the very, very long term. This is a marathon, not a sprint. And over the years, I've looked up to many people. And as the years and decades pass, that list has reduced. Now, it's not to be judgmental. It's just if people drink again, I cease to be interested in what they had. I'm looking at the people who stay sober permanently and stay active in AA permanently. And my great hero in AA was an AA member called Paul M. from Riverside, Chicago. I see someone from Chicago here. There we go. He died with over 60 years of sobriety a number of years ago. He was one of the early members of AA in Chicago. His sponsor, I think, was the founder of AA in Chicago. Died with over 60 years. When he was around 15 years sober, he wrote a lot for the Grapevine magazine. If you want to look him up, you'll find him, Paul M. from Chicago, all over the recovery tape websites. He's not the most scintillating speaker, I have to say. He's not one of your great sort of podium heroes, but he's apparently quite uncomfortable doing the public speaking. He's got a little bit of a kind of comic pitch to get things going, but his heart's not in that. But he's doing it because it's expected. But there's real content in there. There's real content in his writings. And he said that when he was 15 years sober, he discovered that there was a great benefit in redoing all 12 steps, not just trying to live in 10, 11, and 12, but redoing all 12 steps. And that if you do that consistently, year in, year out, the depression, the anxiety, the apathy, the cynicism, the acting out in all of those other areas for which you think you need a dozen other fellowships stops. And that has been my experience, that as I've grown doing the steps again and again and again, one by one, problems disappear, evaporate, fall off. I've never solved a problem since I've been sober. What I've done, I keep doing the steps and the problems are solved for me by being removed, just gone. And so apart from doing the program in a, as I say, a somewhat extreme way, I'm pretty orthodox with how I do it. So nothing fancy. With one thing I would say about step 11, the steps are very clear cut. But only on the matters on which the authors of the big book wanted to be stipulative and clear cut. They leave certain things to the individual. And one of the things they leave to the individual is outside the bare bones of step 11, as it's described on pages 86 to 88, it says, you're going to need to go talk to a priest, minister, or rabbi, get some useful books, learn from some religious people. It talks about getting involved if you're interested in your local religious community. Some people do, some people don't. I've had different positions over the years. Sometimes I've found there have been periods I found that helpful. There have been periods I haven't found that helpful. But here's the point I want to make. The AA program comes first, and anything spiritual is an add-on or bolt-on. And if I can't reconcile what I'm hearing in the outside spiritual or religious tradition with the program, if it seeks to get in the way of that, it has to go. This has to come first. This is what I mean about orthodox. I think we lose in AA as many people out the top and sideways as we do out the bottom. So I keep things very concrete and practical. And with prayer, most of my prayers are about asking God to show me what to do today and to behave myself, to behave well. It's not very complicated. Within 10 minutes, you can get a good list off the internet of human failings or defects. You can get a good list of human virtues. If that's all you did, work away from one list and towards the other list, you'd do perfectly well. You'd be 99% of the way there. So my prayer is not about, and the meditation in the big book is very, very concrete very practical, very much about building a relationship with God, to be God's servant in the day, God's sort of idiot child, just running through the day, doing the next right thing, the next right thing, the next right thing. It's not about achieving transcendental states, altered realities, or glimpses. It's not about hustling the universe for great spiritual insights. There's a little bit of a fad at the moment. I don't know if you've come across it, where people take psychedelics or ayahuasca, but it's okay because it's microdosed on the idea that, you know, if you have a sort of chemically induced spiritual experience, somehow it will get you transfer credits in AA. Now, I've often heard people come back from those. They're always in very glamorous places. You have to pay an awful lot of money to go to, like Costa Rica or Mexico or something. Very expensive. And people get that. They've had these splendid experiences. But you don't hear people saying things like, yes, having had that great spiritual experience, I now fill in my tax return more honestly, and I buy more expensive gifts for my nephews. I've never heard people talk about, they talk about themselves. That's what makes me skeptical. The spirituality about AA, I think, is chiefly about self-forgetting. It's about saying, I'm only one of a very large body of humanity. I'm not going to give my attention to myself. I'm going to give my attention to what I can do constructively for the people around me. And I tell you, the biggest relief, and I'll finish on this, the biggest relief I've had is not to have to worry. Because it's very fashionable at the moment to think about identity. I don't care what my identity is. I tick all sorts of boxes for deviations from the norm. I won't go into what those are. But I don't care. None of those are me. What am I? I'm a child of God, just like everyone else. That is my identity. I'm not a shopping list of things. I'm not a material being. I'm a spiritual being in a human body. And someone said to me, what's your image of yourself? I said, I don't have one. What would I do with one? It serves absolutely no purpose other than to deepen my sense of separation from other people. If I'm me, I'm different than you, and that's a problem. I want to be connected with other people, and I do that by dropping any notion of self and simply saying to God, who do you want me to talk to today? Where do you want me to go? What do you want me to say to who? Just show me the next right thing to do. And doing that, I'm led deeper and deeper into relationships with people in recovery first and people outside recovery second. I've gone all over the place with that. That's what happens when you don't make notes. So I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much for listening.